You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text Thin to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text Thin to 200-300. That's Thin to 200-300. Thin to 200-300.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Welcome to the Big Suey, a podcast exclusive.
Risky move.
Just when you thought the show could not be more diluted.
Walk the plank.
Bam!
No more free Disney trips.
Now here's the marching band of nowhere.
Arr, matey.
Fat face.
Dan's been stress eating.
And the habitual liar.
Stugatz can't be trusted.
The Big Suey.
Yo ho, yo ho, a pirate radio life for me.
I was so disappointed yesterday in my reaction, my own reaction to everything that was happening with Tom Brady. Because first, I really enjoyed that we finally saw that robot be human for just a moment. Look, he doesn't have his legs. He's drunk. He was day drinking. Good for him. But it's also the most human shit you've ever seen from that robot. You've known him for 20 years, made of wires. And you saw, whoa, wait a minute. He gets drunk. It's probably because he's only eaten a strawberry since, you know, the Super Bowl. And it's, or he doesn't eat strawberries, right? He's never tasted a strawberry. Isn't it something like that?
Definitely tasted the avocado tequila, as he may have mentioned.
Okay, but so my reaction was, as seeing him drunk, my immediate reaction was sort of old person. Wait a minute. He didn't drive the boat in that condition, because he showed up at the parade in that condition. But then when he threw the trophy, I'm like, oh my God, he's hammered. You can't be hammered and throw the trophy into the sea, because that could have been a really funny clip that I'm guessing he would have regretted if it had ended up in the water.
No, I don't think there's any bad solution there. Either way, it lives forever. Death taxes Cameron Brate, always there for him.
My reaction, though, was to absolutely, in all of that, not judge him. And this is where he wins again. It was to judge myself as you old person in an equation that involves Tom Brady, the oldest player ever in a Super Bowl, having fun in his 40s, as the guy from Miami who is all about the day drink, who is all about celebrate in the morning on a Tuesday just because you live in Miami and everyone else has to go to work. I looked at myself in a mirror, and this is where Tom Brady wins forever and wins again. Yesterday morning, as he is celebrating his 7th championship, the sports writer, the gas bag, who, like Max Kellerman, dared to doubt that he would be someone who would overcome every single odd as a 6th rounder to get to 7 goddamn championships while he's celebrating drunk and happy. I'm staring in a mirror, not drunk, kind of drunk, and unhappy with myself, because I'm the old media guy shaking a fist at the behavior of a guy who's earned behaving that way.
I love him walking out of that gate. I love the fake. I love him trying to like give off, I'm not hammered. Like the media there is taking pictures of him, and he just gives a wave to the crowd, kind of like, no, everything's fine here. I'm not hammered. This is just normal.
I have a declaration. took 7 Super Bowls, but I am officially a Tom Brady guy now.
Me too.
That guy's good.
I know.
He's good. He's a good footballer.
And he's fun. And a good guy.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. It's clearly skincare that I went to TB12.com last night.
We're putting the red hat to the side, right? Everything else is what we're examining.
Well, Dan, the red hat was to the side, okay? This was before we all kind of knew it was like a serious thing with Donald Trump, okay? I think we might be a little too hard on Tom Brady there, considering the fact that he just won another Super Bowl. My God. Unreal. And he gets drunk too. This is a side of Tom Brady I did not know existed. He's even better looking
if
now.
If he wants to lead an insurrection against America, I'd be okay with it. That's what I'm saying. If he wants to throw trophies at the Capitol because he's throwing 7 of them, ooh, and Mitt Romney has to run out of the building scared.
Right. So I think part of the problem is Tom Brady hasn't publicly come out and said anything about it because he doesn't want to add fuel to that fire. If you wanted to extend him the benefit of the doubt, you're kind of desperately hoping he comes out on the record and says, hey, all that bullshit was bad. Just say, oh, Trump, bad. That's not me. He hasn't said that publicly, so you can hold that against him.
One thing that I would think that might be coming from Tom Brady at some point, because it seems like he is a really good teammate. It seems like guys love playing with him. Mike Evans is now saying he'll take a pay cut. Bruce Arians is saying Mike Evans is a rare superstar that will take a pay cut to stay there. Mike Evans is who we're talking about, which is not the guy you think of as pay cut. Also not the guy I think of as superstar, even though he's a very good receiver. He wasn't very good with Tom Brady. He was just an amazing weapon for them to have, but he wasn't, it didn't feel like he was their number one receiver all season when Baltimore twice is holding him to no catches for 2 yards.
He felt like a bigger superstar when Jameis Winston was quarterback, but when Tom Brady comes to your team, you're no longer the team superstar. That's it.
It became a team. Tight ends, running backs, safe, and really their number one receiver was Godwin all season, right? Like, I mean, we can agree it might have been Mike Evans in name, but I think statistically, or the guy you feared, or the guy most likely to do anything on that team, regardless. All of which is to say, Tom Brady found his voice on Facebook doing a, you know, documentary with Deepak Chopra's kid, where he was really revealing into his life in a way that would make you think.
Is that Gotham Chopra's legal name?
Yeah, that's I don't recognize his first name. Gotham.
Yeah, Mike Evans came on towards the latter part of the year, ended up having a 1,000-yard season.
And do you think of him as their number one receiver?
Yes, easily.
Okay.
Yeah, probably.
Godwin's great though.
It's him or Cameron Bray.
And so you're in, or Gronk. They scored. Yes. They scored 2 tutties yesterday on Sunday. Tutters.
I love that conversation. 2 tutties, tutties, tutties.
For those who don't know, Gronk and Brady were mic'd up when they were on the sideline, and of course Gronk and Brady described it as 2 tutties that Gronk got. So put it on the poll, Guillermo, at Lebatard Show. Are you surprised in any way that Gronkowski refers to touchdowns as tutties? That's just Brady simplifying the language for Gronk, right? Gronk might not know touchdowns, so tutties, that's just Brady shortening it up. I don't feel, you tell me if I'm wrong, that Brady talks that way to anyone else. That's his special trained polar bear language. The same way you'd throw him a piece of fish if he did something successfully. You tell him, hey, Gronk, tutties. Gronk, 2 tutties. You and me, tutties.
So you're saying if it was Cameron Braid, it would have been like, hey, 2 touchdowns, my
That's
man.
Right.
Way to go.
Way
right.
to go, Braid, death taxes, and Braid, 2 touchdowns for Big Bad Braid.
Probably just says, show me your tutties and just laughs and then scores.
That's what I was going to say. It sounds so similar to another word that he
that
likes.
That might be that might be what, hey, Gronk, you motorboated 2 tutties.
It's the most relatable Tom Brady's ever been in his entire career. Even his social media posts, while amusing sometimes, they come off as like a little old guy stiff. Everyone can relate, at least if you were born and raised in South Florida, to backwards hat, shades, and be in 3 sheets by 2 o'clock in the afternoon at some point in their life. It's the youngest he's ever looked. Maybe
it's
the backwards
unbelievable.
Hat. It's incredible. This guy has reversed aging.
It doesn't make any sense. He looks better and healthier than he did at 33.
I can't believe I used to think he was handsome, given how much his face has progressed over the years, because they do that where they show what his face was, and I could have sworn he was a handsome guy at the beginning.
Seriously.
And then by the end of it, I'm like, man, he used to not be that good looking.
We all had the same reaction to that, Stugatz, right? When they did the facial growing up of Tom Brady, and you're like, wait a minute, he's got fat in his face when he he's young. He's pale and he looks unhealthy. He's 23 there. What do you mean he looks unhealthier 20 years ago than he does now?
It was baby fat. He is definitely getting better as he gets older, better looking and better as he gets older. But I think the year in Tampa in South Florida with that sun, because he really looks good. This is the best he has ever looked, period. End of discussion.
He's got to play again, and there's no signs of slowing down. It's already the greatest thing we've ever seen in team sports. He's replaced Michael Jordan. It's unbelievable.
I have a theory. I feel like everyone has a look that at some point in time will be the most attractive look, right? You just have to happen to have it when it's the most attractive look. So like me, for example, there could be a time, or there was a time where it's like, wow, this weird kind of like gangly kind of scrawny person with glasses and a hat, that is it. Like, that's the look. It's just not now. Like, now's not the time for that look, so I'm not benefiting from it.
Billy,
but I feel like there's a time that Chris, if you were alive in like the 1700s, like, you would be like, holy crap, like, this is power. Mm-hmm. This is sexy. Look at Chris. He could be a king.
Yeah, I would crush in the 1700s.
Chris, you would be so great in the 1700s. You'd be better than any of us. Unfortunately, you'd be the fat guy in the forest with an arrow through his head because you couldn't lead anything. You'd be like the 27th in charge, just sort of oafy running around. You wouldn't be in charge of anything. You'd just be part of a really oafy tribe of pillagers.
We actually had a meeting the other day, just to take you guys behind the scenes a little bit, where Gary said to Chris, "Chris, you look like King Henry VIII." And I don't mean that as an insult. And then I Googled King Henry VIII, and I was like, an insult. Not super flattering.
See you, Gary.
No one knows Gary.
Nobody.
No one. You just mentioned Gary. They'll learn. Okay, don't explain the joke. I will not. I'm going to stop explaining the joke.
Now, I mean, if it's the first time you mention the name.
No. Everyone gets mad at me. That is something, that is a joke Billy just made for 9 people.
No, but you explain Gary once to Mike's point, and then you don't explain Gary again. It's the first time we've ever said his name.
You have to explain Bruce. You have to explain Gary. Billy knows what he's doing there.
No. Gary's not even the important part of this story. The part of that story is Google King Henry VIII and see if it looks like Chris Cody.
So
I'm doing it now.
Gary is part of the infrastructure here. I promised I wasn't going to do this anymore, but you guys always do this to me.
That's all you have to say. Don't do it. Don't
said
do
enough.
It.
He's part of the infrastructure. We had a meeting with them. They get it.
That's all you have to say. Like, you just can't pull a random Gary, Billy.
Nah, too much. You got to tease the people a little bit. They want to see. They want to know more. They want to see more. My stories are lingerie, okay? I'm not going to go full nude. I'm going to give you a little peek. Gary, wonder about that.
See you, Gary.
So Gronk rolls in on, we were calling that the SSTD, were we not? Were we not calling that at one point the ship or the boat that Gronk rolls into? Gronktastic celebration. Where do we have, Mike, let's empty the file on some Gronk stuff just to celebrate. I know people are tired of talking about Tom Brady and we should probably move away from it, but I'd just like to empty the file sort of celebrating that these two guys, again, Gronk is the age of Travis Kelce. His body is made of bolts. He is the greatest tight end we have ever seen and somehow is the same age as Travis Kelce because the game has just destroyed his body. And here at the end, he comes out of retirement. You saw Arians quoted, maybe. Sam Farmer, an excellent reporter for the LA Times, gets all these stories all the time. He's been doing it for such a long time. He just goes over to Arians' house and Arians gives it up in terms of talking about everything that happened there. Tom Brady comes into their camp, knows everyone on the roster, knows everything they've got, and tells Arians right there, I think I could get my trained polar bear to come out of retirement as well. And so they got O.J. Howard, and they got Brady, and they got all these weapons, and they built just a wonderful huddle around him.
He got Gronk to block, and then rewarded him with two tutties.
That's right. Well, this is what Stugatz was saying. Stugatz was saying, and you can't put it past him at this point, that you don't actually know as we sit here after seeing Tom Brady drunk and flinging successfully the Super Bowl trophy across a bay, drunk, hammered before noon.
So great.
You don't know for sure that he didn't just thank Gronk in the Super Bowl with two tutties, two little tutties, just to thank him for blocking all season. Just to with the Chiefs. Like, I'm going to throw it 11 yards to Gronk here. Gronk, I'm going to get you a tutty here.
At least one ton.
Thank you for coming out of retirement. Thank you for the 12 back surgeries. Thank you that every year we throw you some fish and you go out there and get 90 catches and 14 touchdowns.
Thank you for blocking for me the entire
season.
Here's a couple of Super Bowl tutties.
It is like throwing him a couple of fish. Yep. I want you to imagine how you would train a polar bear or a seal or something. I imagine that that's what he was doing with the Super Bowl trophy when he threw it to Gronk. Here, Gronk. Was that Gronk who caught it? Wasn't he throwing it to Gronk?
Brate ended up hauling it in.
Of course.
Death taxes and Brate.
Yeah. So good.
Wide open.
What do you have in the Gronk file there, Mike?
Sorry for party rocking.
I would love for you to just empty that file without any context, without explaining any of it.
Turn down for what?
Can't believe we're still talking about these two goddamn guys.
They got those sexy bodies.
Belichick turns off the television, right?
Yes.
Ha, 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 hallelujah. Ha, 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 hallelujah.
Peyton Manning cries himself to sleep at the end of the bed and his neck hurts as the tears roll down a face that looks much older than Tom Brady's.
Yeah.
I think that Gronkowski is not human. I really mean that. I think they feed him out of their hand when he gets off the field. You couldn't haze him. There's nothing you could do to him because there's smoke comes out of when he plays. And when he goes across the middle, you cannot watch him.
Oh my God.
And can you imagine in the cold trying to come in and undercut him? You'll wind up being taken off the field in a stretcher. Gronkowski, who should be tested for something. Because I've never seen a human being like that go off the field. And he, like, snorts to his teammates. There's no English or anything spoken.
He does. He is made of circuits. You're absolutely right.
He really is. There's fire coming out of his helmet. And when he goes across the middle, forget it. What do you think he says in the huddle besides slobbering and breathing and sneezing and stuff? Do you think he knows his own name when they say, Gronk, we're going to you? Or do they just tase him a little bit? Watch Gronkowski. I'm not talking about in the game. I'm talking about in public. You've got to put a leash on him. You cannot let him roam around.
Before we get to Armin Katayan, I got a sports radio topic for you guys.
What do you got?
Could Bruce Arians have been the greatest head coach of all time if he just so happened to be given a shot at coaching Tom Brady earlier? Because Bruce Arians was a two-time coach of the year, once as an interim head coach in Indianapolis when he took over for Chuck Pagano when he was fighting cancer. One coach of the year there. Goes to Arizona. Damn near gets to a Super Bowl in Arizona. Respected everywhere as a great mind that was always considered an assistant because of the Temple ties. He just never got his shot. Now he is one of the more progressive head coaches we've ever seen in that sport.
No,
look
the
at
most.
His staff.
He's a gold standard. No. Not one of the most progressive coach in the history of that sport.
And he just won a Super Bowl with a damn near mid-40s Tom Brady
right.
At this point. This is truly one of the best coaches we've ever seen, and he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, and he's doing this so late in life. His chance at being a head coach came so late. If he were given a chance earlier on in his career, we might be talking about them the way that we talk about Lombardi.
To Coach Brady, you're saying. If he had that chance. Because, Mike, he might have another 10 years with Brady, and he might go down as the greatest head coach of all time.
He did retire once due to health concerns.
It is such a good thing to say, though. Like, just like we said, Tom Brady has had three different Hall of Fame careers. You could, if Belichick hadn't hogged 20 of the Brady years, you could have a situation where he allows both Belichick and Arians to be the best coach of our time if he quarterbacks until he's 53 years old.
Well, then that goes back to Stu Gatz's question. Is Belichick overrated?
I knew you were going to do this because, Mike, thank you for opening the door. I thought that's where Stu Gatz was going to go immediately there. I told you earlier this week we should take Belichick out of the Hall of Fame.
And Tom Brady's not the only other person on Tampa Bay that looks better with age. I've got a framed, autographed by Butch Davis team photo of the 2001 Cleveland Browns, and I was going through it the other day, and on the top line is assistant Bruce Arians, and he looks like shit compared to how he does now. A Kangol hat makes you look so cool.
You think that Bruce Arians is looking...
Low bar, Dan.
He looks better
hat,
now.
That hat?
Yeah, he looks better now. Yeah. Armin Katayan, next.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Armin Katayan has been doing good work across a few decades here on a lot of different platforms, and I wasn't totally surprised to see him in the middle of the Tiger Woods documentary, but he told the story well that I did not think was going to be told well, Stugatz, because when I was cynical about Michael Jordan and the ESPN documentary where Michael Jordan had influence of how his story was told, and so it was flattering in every depiction, and when it was done in 9 parts, I still didn't feel like I knew how it is that Michael Jordan became Michael Jordan. But in 2 episodes, Armin Katayan got an athlete that has been public forever but has never said anything interesting or introspective. He gave you a look at Tiger Woods, whose career we've seen play out on television, that was still surprising to me because it had so much roots in it that explained how he became a great golfer, how he became a sex addict, how he became a drug addict, all of it, and how sports contributed to that. So I wanted to talk to Armin. You should check out the documentary on HBO. It's a very well done piece. I don't know if the Brady one will be good, Stugatz, but I was cynical that a Tiger Woods one could be good because he's so publicly guarded. I didn't think anyone would get in there.
Right. I'm surprised that Armin was able to get in there that deep to Tiger to tell that story the way he told that story. And you're right with Brady. It depends on how much say Brady's going to have over his own documentary, I would guess.
All right. So Armin Katayan joins us now. And the reason I wanted to bring this up, and forgive me if I get too inside here, because if you haven't seen it, I'm promising you that you will find it revealing, even if you're not interested in sports or Tiger Woods or golf or anything. It's just an interesting human story on how someone becomes a maniacal champion in a sport. So I thought a lot of things were interesting about this documentary, but the first question I wanted to ask you, Armin, is deep inside, which is the last clip of Tiger Woods that ended the documentary, I thought was the first time I saw a modern Tiger Woods being interviewed. So it made me feel like the documentary I had just seen, the only time you used anything from an interview from him was at the very end, sort of as the punctuation on his life, 10 seconds, that you got to sit down with Tiger Woods, that he gave access to it, but that at the end, all you got was one snippet of modern clip. Did I get that wrong? Because I thought that was artistic, but
yes,
I thought I might
have. You got it absolutely wrong. So I'll tell you.
Good analysis.
Yeah, that's a great analysis, but it's absolutely wrong. That wasn't us. That wasn't Matt Heineman or Matt Hamacek, the two directors that were really involved in doing all the interviews. That was taken, if memory serves correctly, from Tiger's relationship with Discovery Golf. And he has a exclusive deal with them where he does talk on a YouTube channel or on Discovery TV about certain aspects of his life. And the directors and the archivists for the doc found that somewhere and pulled it and put it in the film. And you're right, it does look like we were talking to him, but I can tell you that the directors reached out, you know, a number of different times to try to engage with Tiger and his people. But as you well know, they're not interested in doing anything unless they have sort of that Michael Jordan control over it. And in the end, I don't think Dana really made a lot of difference to us because, frankly, I'm glad we didn't have him. I think the doc was much, much better. Certainly want to give him an opportunity to respond to certain things. But in the end, I think we knew enough and had enough people that had insight into Tiger's life where it stood on its own.
Armin, I thought the juxtaposition of these two documentaries, one of them in nine parts, hugely popular, the most popular sports documentary ever made, but in collaboration with Jordan to make it an ESPN sneaker commercial in some ways. I thought the juxtaposition of you not having access and them having access was fascinating because your documentary told me so much more in two parts than the Jordan documentary told me in nine.
Yeah, I think what happens is like, you know, when we did, Jeff and I did the book on Tiger, you know, he didn't respond to our request for comment, or he did respond, but it was in a way that it was clear that he wasn't going to talk to us. And, you know, if you spend 3 years, as Jeff and I did, doing the research and the reporting and the writing of the Tiger book, and then that book becomes the basis of the doc, there's just a wealth of information. And you find, if your reporting is deep enough and wide enough, you find times when Tiger's life intersects with those who have never talked publicly before, whether it was Peggy Lewis, the woman at the Masters whose house he stayed at, or, you know, you form a, over 3 years, you form a trusting relationship with Dina Gravel, Dina Parr, his first true love in high school. And she comes and sits down the way she did in the doc. Frankly, you know, I prefer, if I'm going to do a biography that's that deep, and a 360 degree view of somebody's life, unless I'm writing it with that person, I prefer to do it the way that we did it, because you're right. I can't imagine Tom Brady's journey on ESPN is going to be any more insightful than if somebody had been from the outside in. And I think, you know, in our case, it worked to our advantage to not be burdened or hamstrung by having the principal person in the dock.
Armin, what's the most surprising or shocking thing you learned about Tiger that you did not know before you set out on this project?
Well, there are a lot of things. I mean, I think the whole, you know, the whole sex addiction aspect of it and how sex addiction is a form of pain relief. You know, I did probably more research into sex addiction than my wife would have preferred.
Yeah. Baby. Yeah.
multiple interviews with a guy, Bart Mandel in New York, who's a top sex addiction expert. But you learn it's a form of pain relief, just like, you know, whether it's drugs or alcohol or gambling. And I think as you're looking down the road as Tiger, you know, he's going to go off a cliff. You're just not sure, you know, what cliff it's going to be. As his life accelerates and his need for pain relief becomes greater and greater through multiple sex with multiple partners. That was interesting to me. And then I guess Earl's backstory, because, you know, to understand Tiger, you have to understand Earl and what Earl endured in the military and at Kansas State when he was the, you know, starting catcher on and a pitcher on the baseball team and broke the color line in what was then the Big Eight. And how that really imbued Tiger's life, the racial overtones in Tiger's life, even though he ran away from it in a lot of ways, it was very, very important to Earl. So it was really, for me and Jeff, we didn't think in the beginning, honestly, that there was a book there. But the more reading and research that we did, we realized there had never been this overarching view of his life. There had been books about segments of his life, but never, you know, a big picture look that really tried to answer two questions. Who is Tiger Woods and what is the price of genius? And to me, the price of genius has always been far more fascinating than almost any question that we could have asked.
I want to ask a lot about his imprinting, but it's been a long time since I was watching something in sports and I sort of winced at my television, sort of turning my face away from it and my neck away from it. And it wasn't oddly about the sex or any of that stuff.
I think I know where you're going.
Go ahead. Where was it? Where was it?
I think it's the tabloid nature of the fall for me, to that microscope or that the window that we take you into that world where so many people found pleasure in Tiger's downfall. cringeworthy, The View, Jay Leno. It becomes a punchline for the late night comics, and the whole National Enquirer thing to me was, it's a window into how, to me, Dan, that, you know, the downfall of others becomes entertainment for us these days, and it's gotten nothing but worse. And I would not want to be in the crosshairs in any way, shape, or form of that part of our society right now, because, you know, you look at what happened to, and I'm not saying what Morgan Wallen did was right by any stretch of the imagination, but I mean, you know, there's the top country music singer who just basically evaporates in one day for doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. So it's, to me, that was it. But I'm curious as to what you saw.
Armin, I think you've got that one wrong on Morgan Wallen. That has been good for his.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to laugh at that. No,
that's been good for his career.
Yeah, it's quantifiable. These numbers have been better.
People are going
since.
To the actual record store during a pandemic because they want to support
the
guy who used the N-word. Think about that. A record store during a pandemic. That maybe they just like the music, but it feels a little suspicious when you're talking about that guy. In the pandemic, gets kicked off Saturday Night Live because he's making out with somebody, no mask in public, and then he gets caught by TMZ using the N-word. And I do believe so far it's been good for his career because we're not even talking about downloading.
You get wiped off of Apple and Spotify and the highway on Sirius within 24 hours. That, you know, that to me, that's what I find very interesting right now is that there's no leeway on anything. When you're out, you're out. Whether he comes back or not remains to be seen.
Can you help me with what happened at the end of all that tabloid stuff? Because I ended up in the place where I was mortified by how the Masters reacted with judgment to Tiger Woods having sexual infidelity. Like the Masters, that particular place, Armin, protecting the legacy of the guy they're on their hands and knees worshiping when he's the non-black guy walking on their course, gracing it with his excellence. But the moment he has a sex problem, the Masters of all places condemns him for immorality in a way that was parental and was like lashing him across the back with their judgment.
Oh, absolutely. Billy Payne, that moment at the press conference, I actually was there because I was covering Tiger's return for CBS News at the time. And I mean, people were looking at each other out of the, you know, sides of their eyes, like, I can't believe what we're listening to. And, you know, I thought Bryant Gumbel was the perfect person to take Payne to task for that. But, you know, you remember some of this stuff, Dan. You know, it flies by sometimes in our life where it's good to remind people the tabloid frenzy. It's good to remind people that what Billy Payne, the audacity of what Billy Payne had to say in that moment was absolutely, you know, the wrong place and the wrong thing to say. And you know, the beauty and the awe that Tiger could bring on the golf course, all those things, you know, a book is one thing, as you well know, but to see it on film, and the directors, you know, both Matt Heineman and Matt Hamachek and Alex Gibney and Sam Pollard and all the people that were involved in it. I mean, it's nothing but decisions. You have to make very tough decisions as to what stays in the dock and what goes out, how long you spend in some places, whether you briefly touch on something.
You guys blew
it,
Armin. You guys blew it. I wanted another part. You had another part in there. You probably left another part on the cutting room floor. That should have been three parts.
I think we could have done 6 hours if they had wanted to, because there are aspects of Tiger's life. And right now, honestly, there's a scripted series being worked on and written that takes a very different tact into Tiger's life. And I think it's a lot of the things that were on the cutting room floor or they just couldn't get to. But that doc itself, the 3 hours and 15 minutes, it took the better part of 2 years to do. And that's why I think it's so good, is because they were so careful about it. But
so artful. So I can't explain to people how artful it is.
No, Armin, it is artful, Dan.
It's right. Armin, it's really good. But I'm wondering, if you had more, why not use it?
I think it was an HBO decision. You know, when it was down to the end, I don't know, people don't know this, but it was a big bidding war between Netflix and HBO. And we thought at that time, Netflix was buying everything of significance. And we just figured at the end, when it came down to money, Netflix was going to be the one that was going to win out. And it turned out that HBO really wanted it in a way that knocked Netflix out of the water. And I think because it was on HBO, it just didn't maybe have the real estate. They gave us Sunday night at 9 o'clock, which is their premier spot on the network, you know? And so I don't know. I mean, I think we could have done, it could have been 4 or 5 hours, but I don't know whether Matt Hamacek and Matt Heineman could have lasted for that long.
It might have diluted it some. I'm curious what hurt the most to leave out. Like, what, give us the stuff that's not in there that you really wanted to get to, and you're like, you're kidding me. We've got to keep this so short that it's going to be too tight.
There's an aspect to Tiger's life. You saw a little bit of it with Stevie Williams, where he was talking about, you know, I understand, and I'm speaking as Stevie, I understand that you want to make a change as a caddy and that you want to move on, but I didn't think I was going to lose you as a friend. And that cold-blooded nature of Tiger, and that comes from Earl. And that is like father, like son. When you have outlived your usefulness in the House of Woods and you're excommunicated from the church, it's cold-blooded. And there are people that I thought, one gentleman, John Merchant, who was incredibly influential in Tiger's amateur career. John raised a ton of money in Connecticut through a lot of hard work to help fund Tiger's amateur career. John was the one who broke the color line at the University of Virginia's law school, the first black to graduate from the law school. Very prominent African-American attorney in Connecticut. And he was a profound influence on Tiger's life when he was 16, 17, 18, 19 years old. And John was the first one to go onto the USGA's executive committee as a minority. And as such, when Nike ponied up $40 million, $1 million of that money was going to go to minority golf in America. Earl, being Earl, wanted to control that $1 million in minority golf. And he and John, after a couple of too many cocktails, John said something down in Florida, like, the hell you are. I know what's going to happen with that $1 million and it's not going to minority golf. And that was the end of John Merchant. He was cut out of Tiger's life the next day. He was basically summarily dismissed and Tiger never spoke to him again. So I thought some of that part of Tiger's life, that cold-blooded nature, you know, there was an incident at his elementary school that played into the racial narrative that Earl was trying to construct about how Tiger had been tied to a tree when he was 5 years old, his first day of kindergarten. And it was a complete bullshit story. And we reported it in the book and I spent a lot of time knocking it down. That would have been an interesting thing because it would have gone to the racial narrative that Earl was trying to construct at a very early age. The plan was already in place. So some of that stuff. And then, you know, Jim Riswald, the guy who wrote all the great Nike commercials, he's a fascinating guy. I would have loved to have seen a little more of him. But, you know, at this point, Dan, it's water over the falls. And I'm kind of glad I'm done with it because I spent 5 years with Tiger now and I'd kind of like to move on to something else.
Armin, I think that maybe, though, you did have it at the right length because you could have left all that out and simply done what you guys did in the movie, which is illustrate how he broke up with his girlfriend. And it sounded like it was just his parents writing her a letter, his girlfriend of 3 years. You didn't need to go much deeper than that. I didn't think you could have an example better of how coldly the woods will excommunicate you. Even if you're, you know, in love, even if your son might be in love, that's it. I felt like what you guys portrayed is that his parents broke up with that girl. You got her to say it, basically.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and the video, to me, I'd never seen the video. I don't think anybody had seen the video and that to me was one of the more just jaw-dropping moments in the doc, is when you see Tiger as a teenager and actually free and happy, and he's on his back and he's playing an air sax and when I saw one of the rough cuts, I called Matt Hamacek and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe you got that video. And he goes, I know, Dina gave it to us. You know, they acquired the video from Dina. And I was like, oh my God, I can't watch enough of that. And they brought it back in the second part too, which I thought was brilliant. Because you just wanted to see that part of Tiger, which we never got to see.
Dan really critiquing. I mean, Armin and HBO know what they're doing. You're really breaking this down and critiquing, telling Armin what he should have left in, should have left out. Armin knows what he's doing. He's a cagey vet.
I mean, he is a cagey vet, and I hope you don't take this as criticism. I thought it was.
I don't take it as criticism at all. It's really, I mean, you've written long form. You've written books. You know what it's like.
Armin,
I have. You're right. Yes.
Every single day.
Armin, it was a masterpiece. You guys made a masterpiece, and you can see the artful sculpting in it that you had to keep it to 2 hours. So none of this is meant as criticism. What do you regard as the fairest criticism of what it is you guys did?
That's a good question. Well, I can tell you what's unfair first. I mean, for Mark Steinberg, you know, and I have gotten to know just through emails and in his public comments, to call it salacious, I mean, that doc is a lot of things. Salacious is not one of them. And if we wanted to be salacious, I can tell you there were places we could have gone.
Oh, let's do it.
You could have done another hour.
Let's do it.
Do it.
Let's do it, baby. You had the 10-woman orgy. You threw in a 10-woman orgy there. You did not do it as salaciously as you could have. My guess is you could have gotten deep, deep, deep into the Tiger Woods bedroom.
I think there were times in Tiger's life, unquestionably, and you saw a glimpse of it, and I thought they were brilliant about it, when you heard the audio from Lordana Jolie, who was a very high-priced escort, who was being flown around the world for weekends that would be six-figure weekends, and she and Tiger started to hook up. And what was happening in that period of his life was really interesting. And I think that had we wanted to be salacious, and I thought they were brilliant about it. They touched on it, you felt it, and then we moved on. And there was no need to turn it into some sex story, because I don't think that's fair to anybody.
You're right about that. However, I've got to stop you, because the way they did it was very good in that they just breezed by it. Here's 2 quick minutes. We know what you want. Okay, here's a 10-person orgy. Let's get out of here. We're just going to say this is a pain relief thing and get out of here. But I want to start a new segment right now. Get Salacious with Armin Katayan. I think we could blow up. Let's blow up the internet.
See, this is where my career goes right off.
Let's go. Yep. What was that horn dog doing in the bedroom? Everybody wants that information. You are too classy to give it to them on HBO, but this is not a classy place. So give us the goods. Get Salacious.
Stay classy, as they said.
But with Armin Katayan.
What Lordana referred to was interesting. She said, you know, we were all his little puppets. And he would sit in a chair in a business suit and we became his puppets. And I mean, if you want to watch something interesting, Howard Stern had a Tiger Woods beauty pageant, which you can still find on YouTube. And there were 3 different women that were there. Lordana was one of them. And they were basically, it was a contest to win $10,000. And it was Howard interviewing these women about their experiences with Tiger. So for those that are looking for the Salacious with a capital S, they can probably Google that and find it. And that will answer Dan's question. And also probably Stugatz and Chris and Roy. And
classy as always. Ryan, artfully done. Else. Artfully done, Armin.
Not Billy. He's in the middle there at the beach.
That's so right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Billy
I'm
is,
man.
Yes.
It is, and I think you go back to the idea of, like, what Jeff and I were trying to bring to the doc was as a sounding board, and almost like what the journey is. Okay, where do you get off the highway? Where do you get back on? How long do you spend off the exit ramp, and when do you get back on? And those are really hard decisions to make. First of all, you got to figure out what the exits are and what the entrances are, and then you have to figure out, okay, how long do you take before you get to the next one?
That's what I was asking you about. What were the entrances and what were the exits? It's exactly the question.
So, I mean, those are, I think we did I'm trying to think now, and the fact that it doesn't come right to the top of my head probably is reflective that I feel like we did a really good job in telling the story. The one thing we did not want to do, and I think that's, you see at the end, well, I think two things as I think about it. That Earl speech that bookends the doc, where you see him at the dinner, where for the first time no one had ever seen that video before, and it was very hard to acquire in the Haskins dinner. They had to trust Matt Hamacek and Matt Heineman to use it properly. But that's like Earl talking from the grave, you know, and in those terms. And then to bookend it with Tiger and Charlie hugging at the end, I thought that was really good. But we shied away from that morality stance where you say, oh, this is a redemption story. Tiger has been redeemed. I mean, that's just really dangerous ground to walk on. And we didn't want to do that. And I think that where Pete McDaniel was so good for us is, you know, in that voice talking almost from Earl is that in the end, Tiger's, you know, he's a human being. And I know that sounds trite, but when you deal with Tiger Woods, humanity is not the first thing that comes to mind. And I think he's more human now than he's ever been. But I will say this, Dan, as I was talking, I was thinking, you know, the book opens in Manhattan, Kansas. And it's really the story of Earl's grave. And the fact that Earl Woods is buried in an unmarked grave in Manhattan, Kansas, tells you, I think, volumes about his wife, Tita. And to me, that was always Tita's revenge for Earl. And if you know anything about Earl Woods, there would be spotlights on the monument. There'd be a band playing 24 hours a day. I'm the father of Tiger Woods. But the fact that you can't find his grave unless you have a map and you find a little marker in the ground, to me, of all the things that we found out in our reporting, I remember when the sexton from the cemetery told me that, and I literally had to put my phone down for a second. I went, could you, Mr. Mueller, can you explain that one more time to me? You can't see his grave? He goes, no, you wouldn't know. If you didn't know where it was, you'd never be able to find it. Now, that's beyond my psychological capabilities, but that's pretty interesting.
Oh, but Armin, it's interesting from a million different perspectives, and this is why I wanted the documentary to be longer. If what you're saying is also across the universe and the cosmos, this man who was a soldier of great discipline, building a Messiah that he told you was going to be a Messiah, and it was very important for him to be that Messiah, and then Tiger Woods cuts him out of the life out of the end, largely because Tiger Woods needs to break free of the robot they made, that he would pass down to his son this infidelity that would harm the family, both of them. The idea of that, I thought in the building of Tiger Woods that she was as responsible for the disciplined robot that he became as he was, and the betrayal at the end, for it to be that public, the shame of both her and Tiger Woods' wife, to do that to women, to break them with that kind of public shame and make them be the graceful ones. That's what you're saying with that symbolic punctuation, right? She, absolutely. Her revenge, I mean, sent him to the grave. Always,
I think Tita's as fascinating a character as Earl is, because if you just think about it as a chemistry experiment, and you've got Earl with a one beaker in one hand, which is the love of golf and the passion for the game and visualizing and Tiger's love of practice. And then the other beaker, you have Tita, who is the assassin. She's the one with the, you take their heart, you step on their neck. You know, they remember how you beat them, so they never want to play you in those moments again. I mean, you put those two together and that creation is Tiger Woods. To me, that's just fascinating. And then when you understand when Tita and Earl separated right after Tiger turned pro, and Earl was living in the house on Teakwood, and Tita had a beautiful home a few miles away that Tiger bought for his mother, what was happening in that old family home with Earl during Tiger's huge runs, and you know, he's basically just he's iconic at that point in time, 2000, 2001, but he's dealing with a lot of dad issues back home. That's a whole nother. You could have done another hour on what was happening between father and son in that period of time.
All right, Armin, I'm not going to do this with you. I'm going to end this right now because okay. We've knocked the entire show off kilter here talking about something that I've got a million questions about. So I'm going to talk to you on a South Beach session about more right. of this.
You have
stuff.
A million more questions?
I do. I've got a ton of questions because I'm telling you, this guy made a work of art. He sculpted. Look, this is a very good journalist who has spent decades perfecting his craft and in storytelling and how he does this. And so he spent years immersed in this subject matter, and the documentary is just a fraction of what he knows. And so if you enjoy the art that this man made with his colleagues that gave you an unusual look into an icon you thought you knew and how he became that, I'm not just endorsing the movie. I'm telling you that I'm guessing that Armin's as proud of this as anything he's ever done because it's an amazing story, well told, and I've got a ton of questions about how he made it. So anyways, awkward way of complimenting you and criticizing you. I don't know why Scott has spent the interview segment.
You know, it's funny.
You've
never done that to anybody before. You know,
I have been yelling at you. It's weird.
I don't understand. Do you not? What do you? Did
it
you
feels
watch?
Like you're attacking Armin Kataya.
I'm going to attack
no, no,
you.
No, no. I think it's a nice. I am as proud of this as of anything I've ever done. And you know, and like you, I've been doing this a long time over a, you know, whether it was network television or other books or things of that nature. But, you know, this was a work of art. I really believe in it. And I had a small paintbrush in it, but I'm really proud to be involved with Gibney and Hamacek and Heineman and Jenna Millman and Sam Pollard and all these other people. Cause I got to tell you something, this was when I saw the credits and I'm literally looking at it, the credits for the first time, I'm like, holy shit, there's a lot of people that worked on this doc. And I didn't realize, I mean, if you just look at the list of interns, it filled an entire screen. And I don't even know what they did, but they did enough to get a credit in the film. And to me, that's extraordinary because I know just from the archivist and what they went through to get all that video. I mean, that shot when they're talking about Earl's infidelity and the Winnebago, and you see the Winnebago.
Well, this is the thing I wanted to ask you. You said hard to acquire footage. I want to ask you about that. The friend crying on camera, just saying on camera that I taught Tiger Woods how to be unfaithful. I couldn't. Well, there are a lot of things.
Joe Groman.
But
I know.
Stugatz, you haven't seen it yet, have you? Stugatz, you have not seen it yet because you wouldn't be this kind of asshole to me during this conversation if you'd actually watched this with your dad like I told you to.
I'm getting to it. I saw part one. I have not seen part two. I'm waiting to see part two. My mom's funeral got in the way, Dan.
You haven't. Oh, there.
His mom died.
Mom died again. You mother. Armin, thank you for being on with us.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot, Danny. Talk to you.
You mother.
See you, Armin. I saw the whole thing. Joe Exotic. I mean, it's crazy, that guy.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.